morning, we want to welcome you all to a rules hearing. The schedule today is for a hearing on 08-01 in the matter of the amendment of rules or pleading practice and procedure, Wisconsin Stats Section Chapter 756 relating to juries. After we conclude this hearing, we will then proceed to an open administrative conference dealing with this rule and other rules as set forth in our agenda. The presenter is the is Judge Patak of there you are, of Racine. I was going to stall, thinking you were still on your way, Judge.
Good morning, Chief Justice Abramson and members of the court. I'm appearing here today in my capacity as the chairman of the Chief Judge's Committee on Jury Treatment and Selection. We're asking the court to approve and to sign an order adopting the petition that we filed, amending provisions of Chapter 756, which is designed to improve and to clarify provisions regarding jury management. I wanted to focus in my comments to you on two areas that are affected by our petition. The first has to do with the list of prospective jurors that is compiled and provided to each county on an annual basis to the clerk of courts. Under our current system, we use the Department of Transportation list, which comes through the CCAP system, through the CCAP jury management system, to the clerk of courts. The clerk of courts annually asks the director to supply a certain number of jurors for their annual jury year to use for selection. The clerks proceed by sending out jury summonses. And really, that's really where our problem begins. We have found over the years that the Department of Transportation list is fairly accurate with respect to the proportionate representation of minorities. However, once we mail out our summonses, that seems to change. Summonses are mailed and some come back as being undeliverable. That means that the address we have is not a good address for the person. Some don't come back and are presumed to be delivered, and some are not responded to once they are delivered. And others, obviously, the majority of them are responded to, and we get responses from the prospective jurors. We've worked on this for some time now, and the committee's determined, decided rather, that in consultation with experts, including experts from the National Center of State Courts on Jury, that the best way to address this issue is to find a better list. And in this case, a better list equates with a list which has better and more current addresses. I was looking at my license as I was sitting here waiting, and your driver's license is renewed every 8 years, which might explain part of this, but there's also a requirement that citizens are to file a change of address with the DOT once they change their address, and apparently that's not being done by everyone. So once we get our lists, our mailings back on the summonses, we find that the undeliverables, by checking statistically in measures, decreases the representation of the minority group. Further, the no returns also decreases the representation of the minority group. So when we end up with a list that starts out looking pretty good in comparison to what the census tells us, we find that our minority representations are decreasing because of the reasons I stated. So our petition asks you to change the law with respect to getting a better list. And the list that we are proposing in the rule are voter registration lists, tax filers, child support payers and payees, unemployment compensation information, and then Wisconsin residents who have licenses through the DNR. This requires that these lists then would have to be merged or put together as one list. And this would be done by the use of automation. The list would be received by the director's office, and when I say director, I'm really saying CCAP. And the CCAP system would then merge the lists. The issue then becomes, how do we identify people and purge the list of duplicate names? The problem we have with that is, how does a computer system best identify an individual? And the best identifier is the Social Security number. Think of a date of birth, my date of birth, February 1st, 1947. A lot of people have that date of birth.
That's confidential, right, yeah.
My name is sometimes misspelled. My name, Gerald, is sometimes supposed to be spelled with a G, sometimes with a J. Those are the sorts of things that computers can't necessarily determine.
Or the middle initial, which...
Correct, the middle initial.
Sometimes you use and sometimes you don't.
Correct. So our proposal is that the list would then be compared by use of that individual unique identifier for each of us, which is our Social Security number. That information would be kept at the state level in the director's office. That is information that would be used simply for merging the lists and purging it of the same individual being named twice, making sure that we don't have that person on the list twice. That information, the Social Security number, would remain at the director's office in the CCAP system. And then the list itself, once merged, would come to the clerk of courts with name, address.
Does the clerk of court only get a residence in that county?
Yes.
Okay. Doesn't get the massive list. Just
we would ask in Racine County, we usually ask for 10,000 names annually from Racine County, obviously, mm-hmm. since they could only serve on our juries.
Okay. Right. So now the clerk gets the 10,000 or whatever the number is, right? And that's your estimate of how many you might need during the coming year?
Correct.
Okay.
And it's provided one time per year.
But you can ask for more if you should run short, I assume.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. So I guess the point of this is to make you understand that the Social Security number, we understand the issues of confidentiality. That's part of what the petition addresses in other ways. And the need to keep that information confidential would be to keep it at the state level in the control of the CCAP software, basically.
You know, Judge, we've had notices in the newspapers twice within the last 3 months of the state sending out things with people's Social Security numbers on that were designed to be kept confidential. And it causes me some concern that the provisions for confidentiality are that it's kept at, quote, CCAP. I don't know if there's a better way of handling it, but it's a lot of responsibility for the court system, and if we goof up like the state has done in its other agencies recently, you know, that's really not what we want to propagate.
And we understand that concern. We share that concern, and I guess I would say two things. One is, I think we can rely on CCAP to take whatever measures are necessary to protect the confidentiality. And two, I would stand on the track record of CCAP in terms of my daily experience, in terms of the integrity of court records. I'm not aware of any instance in the state where the system's been entered, someone's altered a record, anything of that nature. So I think it's proven itself to be very secure, a very safe way of keeping information.
Could you discuss the relationship between the lists that would be acquired and the public records law?
I think that the statute and the way we contemplate is that information regarding Social Security would be kept confidential. I think the open records law is to be balanced with what the need for confidentiality is, and we're going to address that later in another presentation in terms of the questionnaire that's filled out by the juror and how that remains available in the course of litigation. But I think that we contemplate that the jury information that's provided to make the master list would be available. And what the clerk of courts gets from CCAP is the name and mailing address of the person. So that obviously is available in the system. However, with respect to the questionnaire, the next step that follows, where the jurors fill out their questionnaire and mail it back, they provide other information to us, including such information as occupation, et cetera. And in some counties, it's more than that because they've expanded the list. And that's information that we're trying to protect in terms of attempting to afford jurors some sense of confidentiality and privacy.
Well, let's just play this out and give me some assurances here. John Belker comes to work one morning, and there is a demand for complete documents supplied by the Wisconsin Department of Transportation that are to be merged into a total juror list. And that document, as received by him, would have Social Security numbers. And how does he respond to that?
I would respond by saying it's not my record. It is the Department of Transportation or the Department of Revenue's record. Make your request to them. They've simply supplied me with a list, and they're the person or the entity that supplied it. Go to the source. That would be my response. Maybe that's, in your mind, I understand the question you're asking is to pass the buck to some extent, but I've had this issue come up locally with respect to records that exist and really deferring to, you know, who is the keeper of the record, who is the possessor of the record, and, you know, it's their record. We just have it for a purpose, and thus asking that the demand be made of
them. As I read the proposed rule, the Department of Transportation shall transmit the list to the Office of the Director of State Courts, and without charge. I mean, this is not sort of passive, they just turned it over. It was a demand that this come to the Director of State Courts.
This has to do with working with each of the agencies on this list to make agreements to get this information. And one of the issues is the Social Security number again. And we are working with those agencies, I believe two of them, the Revenue Agency and Workforce Development, have begun to take steps toward legislation that would allow them to give us information, which would include the Social Security number.
Well, why do they give you the information now? Don't you work with the Department of Transportation?
Department of Transportation gives us information now without cost, correct.
Yeah, this doesn't change that.
No. No, only as to other agencies, right.
Right. And one of the recommendations here is to use a May.
Sorry?
One of the recommendations here was that some of the shalls should be changed to May.
Right.
Right.
With respect to the other agencies on the list.
Right.
That's correct. And we agree with those changes.
Right. That was my understanding because you run into not only state statutes but maybe some federal problems. So that if you do May, there's an opportunity for discretion and movement.
Right.
That's my understanding. If I don't have it right, you should tell me.
No, you're correct. Okay. I would point out, as long as you mentioned the federal law, there is a provision in the U.S. Code, I think it's 42 U.S. Code 405, that does allow for the disclosure and sharing of the Social Security number for the purposes of creating jury lists. So
I'm assuming that, otherwise you'd have problems.
Right.
Of asking for that, and that I'm assuming also in a whole variety of the lists that are referred to by you and other people, that those lists have Social Security numbers on them.
Yes.
Because that would be needed for identification in those particular areas. I mean, I can't remember about the driver's license. I guess it's almost been 8 years.
They do have your Social Security number.
Well, that's what I thought, but I did not stand there and say, no, I'm not going to give it to you. I probably gave it to them.
As we all do.
Yeah, right. Okay.
The other thing I wanted to mention is other alternative means of trying to correct the issue of underrepresentation of minorities. There is an approach that was discussed by the committee And that's referred to as a stratified or targeted summonsings. That basically is to take a look at your jury list, for example, and to realize that you're underrepresented by a particular a minority, and then finding, as an example, a geographic area that might have a higher representation, and then adding to your list a proportionately greater number of people from that area to try to raise the level of the representation. Our Wisconsin statute, I just want to start there by giving you some phrases that appear in the jury statute. 756.001 sub 3 contains the phrase, no person may be excluded. Sub 4 contains a number of phrases. It says, selected at random in one part. It refers to an equal opportunity to be considered for jury service. It refers to equal probability of selection. And case law in Wisconsin, well, there isn't a lot, but there is some which has dealt on that discussion. One is a Court of Appeals case from 1993. It happens to come from Racine County, but in a civil case, a judge went out and had the bailiff find a minority person and added them to the array after the process of computer-generated lists and random selection had taken place. And in that case, the Court of Appeals held that the method of selecting juries and creating lists is a mandatory statute. It held that that randomness is really the ethos of the jury system by picking juries at random, and that said that while it was a noble undertaking, well-intended, that adding a juror in that manner was not a random selection, and it overturned the verdict in that civil case. The committee asked staff, legal staff in the director's office, to write a memo about whether we could, in fact, look at this way of enhancing a jury list. And the staff opinion was that we could not, and we then followed that up with the director's request to the attorney general about whether we could use stratified or targeted summonsings to enhance the minority participation. And in an attorney general's opinion of February 20th of 2008, we were told that we could not. And I'll just read you the concluding paragraph that summarizes it. The attorney general in that letter stated, Wisconsin law, which requires that all qualified persons have an equal opportunity to be randomly summoned for jury service, does not permit jury selection system that gives some persons a greater and other persons a lesser opportunity to be summoned depending on the area of the community where they live, end of quote. So we view that to be a clear enough statement of the law for us not to ask that to be a part of our petition.
Judge, I've got a question about something that was not addressed as part of the petition.
Yes.
And that's section 756.25.
Okay.
And specifically the concept of per diems that was addressed by the March 21st letter from the Wisconsin Association for Justice. Now, we do know that many low-income people are non-salary. They're paid on an hourly basis.
Yes.
And simply, quite frankly, can't afford to take time off of their job, whether it's part-time or full-time, at a rate of $16 per day for the per diem. Was there any thought process or discussion
Yes.
relative to this issue, and is there any specific reason why it was left unaddressed in the proposal?
This provision was discussed by the committee. It was the committee's considered opinion that we should not enter this area, that counties we have surveyed over the years have varying amounts that they pay jurors. 16 is the statutory minimum. Some counties have gone above that. I think the average is probably about $25, which almost seems laughable, I understand, when you're asking people to give up their day. On the other hand, we felt that our purpose here was to try to increase the participation of minorities and make the list more representative as best we could, and that we didn't want to mandate to counties the increase of jury fees. I will tell you that from my experience, probably at least 50% of the companies that employ people are civic-minded enough to say to the juror, you go serve on jury duty, you give us your jury fee, we'll give you your daily pay. Okay, that's what happens in most cases. It doesn't happen, obviously, to the self-employed, to the unemployed or underemployed, but I think there's a good amount of civic-mindedness among business owners in the state that do that.
I'm not as confident of that as you may be.
Yeah.
And the concern that I have is if we're talking about areas where we can actually increase participation of people of color in the jury process, then if you've got individuals who either rightfully or wrongfully think that they're going to lose money, their hard-earned day's wage, whether it be a part-time job or a low-paying income for that day, and they're looking at 16 or whatever the county rate might be, they may just make an economic decision to go ahead and go to work. And unless it's clear to them that they're going to at least be able to put food on the table for their families, the rest of what we're doing here may have no practical effect. And that's the concern that I have, is that this seems to be the one area that may actually do the most good, and it's the one area that's not addressed at all by the petition.
And again, we did that after discussion, deciding that we didn't want to have you in the proposed rule mandate the counties an increase in having to pay more money, which is the state-county issue right on the table, so to speak. And I understand the issue, and I agree with you. It is a concern.
Well, when you look at Chapter 756 in the statute books, much of it, but not all of it, seems to have, at least from as far back as I can look here, its genesis in a court rule. Is that essentially correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Some of these provisions have never been changed by the state legislature, which they could.
Right.
Some of the provisions seem to have their genesis in statute, at least under the, from what I can see here. Although even the statutory provisions have then been revised or amended in some form by the court. The amount of pay, which is $756.25, that's the $16, at least in the statute books, the genesis is in a 1973 statute, and then has been subsequently amended by this court, and I can't tell whether the amount was amended. So this is a just policy decision of not doing that because it's a county.
Yes. I guess I would say if it's the consensus of the court to want to increase that, then if you wanted us to give you some feedback, we could have the committee suggest how that could be done, if that's your decision. Okay?
We have a number of, I shouldn't say a number, but people have suggested other items, like I think the Department of Justice suggested that you put in that on consent of the parties you could have a six-person criminal jury. I mean, if I'm wrong, tell me.
Yes, they did file a letter.
Right, and constitutionally, in Wisconsin, it's required for 12, as I understand.
As this court has held, right, in State versus Hansford, I believe.
And I gather that you thought that would be outside the realm of this provision,
right,
which is, as I see it, in attempting to deal with bringing them in, not the substantive issues of once they get there, but people want to do other things, and like the $16, like this. So where do we draw the line? I mean, once we're going to try and do something that's good for jury management, where draw the line, Judge?
Well, and regarding the number of jurors, we changed that simply because it's our opinion that that reflects the law, the current state of the law is decided by this court.
Well, that's because, and the present statutes have a note that as to the sixth person, that it's unconstitutional. So that would make sense. And at least it's arguable it can make sense. Okay.
Yes.
But you don't want to go further than that about consent, et cetera?
No.
Okay. So, too substantive?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Judge, let me, if I might, ask you about the forfeiture when a person fails to appear.
Yes.
Now, I know there's been some suggestions running the gamut, I think, from $50 to $500 to $200. What's the committee's position at this point?
Well, the committee's asking to change the statute so it's consistent. There was an amount of $40 to be assessed for not appearing and $500 for not returning a summons. The inconsistency is something the judges, like myself, have already been concerned about, and a lot of discussion has ensued. So we changed it to make it a forfeiture of up to $500. It still is discretionary, as we interpret the words we've crafted here, for the judge to decide what amount, if any, he or she would impose. We don't presume judges to be draconian or to be not willing to listen to jurors. I would expect that the scenario that would unfold if a juror doesn't return a summons or doesn't appear is that they would be provided a court-generated document ordering them to appear based upon this forfeiture statute we've created. They would appear before the court. The court would have a dialogue and ask them why they didn't appear, give them a chance to correct it by appearing, attending, or completing the questionnaire, and deal with it that way, and then, as a last resort, impose a forfeiture for the recalcitrant juror who won't fill out the questionnaire or won't appear and doesn't have a reasonable excuse for that. I think that some of the letters that were written, in my mind, seem to forget about the fact that judges do have discretion. We didn't write up to a $500 forfeiture to mean it had to be $500, but rather that judges should exercise their common sense and their judicial discretion in imposing an amount that they feel is appropriate. We've also gone one step further, and we've actually written what we're referring to as a best practices procedure that will be used to, if this does become the rule by your order, to inform judge and educate judges about how we envision that they will enforce this statute.
Do people show up in regard to this second notice when they didn't show up for the first notice?
Absolutely. It's one of the most effective things to try to correct a non-response, yes.
A couple of entities and people have indicated that there are other lists that they would like you to consider, and your prepared remarks today in large part address the issue of lists and then the other alternative approach.
Right.
Have you had an opportunity to review the letters that have been submitted
yes.
to the court?
Yes.
Does your committee have any objection to those additional suggested lists or any comment regarding those?
We want to have an opportunity to consider the lists, what they're comprised of, the source, et cetera. I'm thinking in my mind at this moment about the request from a fellow judge about the Indian tribes in the northern part
judge
of the state.
Judge Nielsen, yes.
And we had done some, once we got the letter, we did some preliminary legwork, Gail Richardson did, and tried to find out what list that would be. And apparently each of the tribes maintains its own list. There doesn't appear to be a collective list. We feel that based upon the fact that the tribes are sovereign nations, that it would be appropriate for us as the committee to make a gesture to them to ask them about this issue and see what they suggest and see what their lists are. And we're willing to do that, and if in fact they have a suitable list that might help in the northern counties primarily or in other counties where there are significant populations of American Indians, to add that through legislative change later on. But we feel, without knowing what the list is, whether there is such a list, it may be premature to do that.
Well, go ahead.
I note that Judge Nielsen copied his letter to the Wisconsin Tribal Judges Association.
Yes. So, again, we need As these things unfold, this is a new experience to me in terms of supporting a petition before the court. Believe me, I'm here tomorrow on another petition, and my emails last week were fast and furious as all these changes are responded to by the committee who are and the people who are working on this to try to adjust and to respond. So
the court understands that, since the court is faced with the same issue.
Yes.
if I may, follow up. In addition to the list, there's been a recommendation or a question raised in a March 21st letter from the Wisconsin Association for Justice, and it reads, did the Subcommittee on Jury Treatment and Selection consider using the U.S. Postal Service or some other service that verifies or updates addresses? And a second question, did the Subcommittee consider the return service should be requested anytime something is sent to potential jurors?
That was not discussed as such by this committee. I think it's been discussed in the past. And certainly, if a juror is not responding and the questionnaire is not being returned, a clerk could elect to use certified mail, et cetera, that sort of thing, to verify that it's being received, obviously.
Mm-hmm. What about the first of those two questions? That is, whether or not the committee considered using the Postal Service to verify or other service to verify or update addresses. Any consideration of that?
Sure. I think that happens, if I'm not mistaken, when the mailman delivers or attempts to deliver it. You get the sticker back on it that says the address has changed. So that does happen, I believe, in the mail process, so that the clerk would get back the envelope which says it's not delivered, moved to a new address, and it generally has notified them of that. They can search it out and get the new address and correct it.
We've got I note that in the petition it says the director may, let's see if I can find it again, may consult with or may request lists, and then there's a list of the lists, and then number six in that was the tribal. So it's my question is broader in the sense that if the court added, and we've got more lists potential, added them, it doesn't necessarily mean as presently drafted that you have to include them. It just means consider these.
Correct.
I mean, as it's drafted now.
Yes.
And is that a correct understanding of the
that
draft?
That is a correct understanding, and we're not opposed to changing some of that language, which is mandatory, to may. We recognize it's a cooperative effort between the director's office and these governmental entities who are the possessors of these lists to try to reach an agreement in terms of the exchange of information and to see that the lists come to the courts for our purpose.
It says here, the office of the director may use any of the following. May request the following information from custodians. And then it would add in federally recognized Indian tribes. So it seems to me that's very, it leaves a lot of discretion, which you might like or not like, in the director's hands.
Yes.
So you could add 10 more lists. Doesn't mean the director's going to use them.
I would agree with you. It's may. It's not mandatory.
Not mean. So that brings me to the next list. That is in today, and we'll hear from Karen Rotger of the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin, who wants to use additional lists. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at that.
We received the earlier letter. If there's a more current letter than the one that was sent initially, I haven't read that.
April 7th, and it'll be her testimony, today. Okay.
I have not seen that.
And there it's a number of other lists one list, and a discussion of privacy interests.
Yes. And again, the committee's view is that, not that we have a proprietary interest, but we would like to be able to evaluate the list to see whether they are suited to our purpose.
Before they get listed.
Yes, if possible. Okay.
Thank you, Judge.
And thank you all very much.
Before you leave, and you will have an opportunity after other appearances, you or someone you designate, to do a wrap-up for a few minutes. this committee has worked long and hard and over a number of years to do this, and both at the state level and consulting with various national groups that work in this field. And it's the jury is, of course, a basic right under the state and federal constitutions.
Essential to our process.
Yeah, we're not going to argue what the Seventh Amendment covers, but we've got enough coverage under the state constitution and that in a basic concept of American law. So the jury pool is very important, and we want to thank you for all of your work.
Thank you. Thank you for your consideration.
And thank you to the entire committee. Now, I have a list of appearances, which are four. The list is four now. But others may appear and speak, and you need not be a lawyer to appear and speak on this petition. So my list now is Susan Raymer, Clerk, Columbia County Circuit Court, Gail Richardson, District 5, Court Administrator, Karen Rotker of the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin, and Mitchell Hagopian of Disability Rights Wisconsin. If anyone else would like to appear, would you give your name to the marshal, Tina Nodal, so they know who you are? Good. All right. You're ready to go, Ms. Raymer.
I believe so. Good morning, Justices. I am Susan Raymer. I have been connected with the legal and judicial system all of my adult life, or for 37 years. I have been the elected clerk of court in Columbia County, our neighboring northern county, for 8 years. And I became a part of this committee about 2 years ago and found it to be a unique situation in that this is one area that we as clerks can deal with the general public rather than deal with those individuals who come through our court system on a daily basis facing life's difficult decisions, as evidenced by the court cases that are filed with us. So this is near and dear to a lot of the clerks' hearts. And I am here to just throw a practical aspect of some of the proposals and suggestions in this petition. In today's world, our citizens are not delegated to one county quite often. They live in one county, they work in another, they participate in activities in other counties. And when one of our jurors usually gets a summons or a questionnaire, one of the questions that they always are discussing in the jury room or with us is, how did I get to be on jury duty? Is this consistent with, say, Dane County or our neighboring counties? And this petition, I feel, has done a really great job in addressing the consistency issue across the board with the idea of the selection of different source lists. Having one agency, the director's office, compile those jury array lists eliminates the questions that clerks have had across the years, are we doing enough to get a cross-section of jurors? We have been given that list, but we're always pondering with new ways of improving things and with our own staff issues, should we be developing a local list, a voter list, some other list? And this takes that out of our hands and puts it in the hands of the director's office in a standard, consistent way for all 72 counties, done in the same manner, using the same source list. So it's a relief to the clerks in that it's something that is taken off our plate, with the idea that hopefully it's going to help us in the end and with our workload, because with these new source lists, we're hoping, and it's anticipated, that we would have better addresses to work from. This should present the better representation and cross-section that the judge spoke about, and we're hoping that it will also relieve some of the time and perhaps expense that the clerks undergo in tracking down all of those undeliverables, trying to get better addresses, trying to resend them, the cost of trying to get a different address and perhaps sending them certified, all of the other courses that we take to try and get that original jury panel to the courthouse. So we're hoping that with these new lists and with standard, again, consistent standard lists across the board, it's also a measurement tool for when we compare apples to apples, so to speak, to compare how we're doing, how our performance is with the jury, Are we getting to the things we want to get to? In the past, my jury year was May to May, and I know my neighboring counties of Dodge County had a July to July jury year. Sauk County, another neighboring county, had a January to January year. And through this petition, with a standard jury year for everyone of January 1st through December 31st, we can compare side by side small counties to large counties or similar counties in size, how we all are performing at the state level across the board. And this, in turn, should come back, and we can say to our jurors when they walk in, yes, we are giving the best, fair, persistent, consistent selection of the jurors. So that has been one focus as far as on a practical side.
Is there anything you don't like about this petition?
The issue of, again, the issue that Justice Butler brought up. If I were to say what is the one reason that we get quite often at this county level is the amount of what they are getting for jury service. Again, that varies. And our standard answer, which with the judges and also with, I think, clerks across the state, are very well aware of going to our county boards and saying, you know, we need $80 a day or whatever the case may be. And so we usually talk about it being a civic duty, your country asking you to do very few things, and this is one of those. And after some really serious conversations with our jurors, we find that most of them are receptive to coming in for that amount. Our judges will, in their own discretion, excuse some if it is an absolute hardship. I come from a small county, so our jury service is limited to usually one day, 2 days a month. And again, I guess I don't feel, after being within the legal system, that that's too much to ask of anybody, as long as it doesn't go into lengthy, you know, jury service of any sort.
Any attempt made to get counties to join in a petition that increases the payments to the jury?
There is always discussion about that, and it's usually not one of, the main concerns. In fact, it was very interesting. We had two of our county board members summoned, and they were two that were trying to get out of it.
Was that done randomly? I want to know.
And it was, it was interesting to hear their arguments as well. Counties are...
They serve?
They did. They were not excused for any reason. It's also interesting to see that counties become creative in perhaps providing lunch or providing a bus ticket or providing reimbursement for mileage. So we try to compensate. I bring baked goods in to assist. So, I mean, it's creative. It doesn't help with that bottom line. But again, that was not the focus of this petition or something that was addressed. The other question that our jurors come in with all the time, they're very apprehensive. I don't want to say mistrusting. But they're looking for a fair shake on our end, and they want to observe a system that is run professionally, that is run effectively, and that seems to be consistent across the board.
I have a question. The pay for the jurors, that is jurors' fees, is the juror shall receive an amount not less than $16 as fixed by the county board. Mm-hmm. Do you know how many counties pay more than $16?
We had a discussion, sort of an informal survey at our last association. There are very few counties that are still paying $16. There are some that are paying $40, $50, $60. As the judge indicated, probably across the board, they'd be $25 or $30 per day plus mileage. Again, looking at the
That's
amount
more
of,
typical than I gather, 25 to 30
right.
a day. That's still a low for a day's work.
Mm-hmm. Extremely so.
What about other states?
I think we're very comparable to what other states are. I don't have information. We have, the committee had gone through that on a number. And again, it was whether the statutes actually covered or if they were leaving it up to the counties with again, the minimum level and leaving it up to the counties or the state.
As a matter of public policy. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Ms. Raymer, while we're on the subject, what's your experience as far as companies in Columbia County continuing to pay jurors at their normal earnings if they were working for that company on that day?
Actually, for those that work in Columbia County is not the most, they're not known for their manufacturing or their larger counties, so it is not one of those counties that does have a lot of that. However, all of them have pretty much come on board with they will pay their entire salary. A few of them will ask that the jurors turn in their money then to the company, or they will allow them to keep that as well. So companies are very responsive, and we always instruct our jurors through our jury orientation that if their company in any way, shape, or form questions them about their pay or about their serving or there was an instance where one company was, this was the only day a juror had missed in their day's work, and they were going to withhold a bonus-type package for them for that year because of that. And our judges went to bat and saying, hey, you know, had he not been here, he would have been at work. And the company, after listening to the court's explanation, went ahead and he received the bonus that he was entitled to.
When the committee was discussing the $16 a day, was there any information provided as to what happens generally in the state of Wisconsin as far as companies continuing to pay the normal rate of pay for that particular employee?
I think this area of the petition had been discussed. I just came on the committee about 2 years ago, and I think that issue had been dealt. Perhaps Gail will be speaking next, and perhaps she has some further information. It was not at that time. It was pretty much had been discussed, and we were really on to the source lists and those areas of the petition. So I was not involved as in-depth with that discussion.
I'll just indicate that when I was on the bench in Brown County and in northeastern Wisconsin, that it was very, very usual for companies, especially there were a number of large paper companies and manufacturing companies that would pay the normal rate for that particular day. In some instances, there was a real hardship. I remember farmers, for instance, really facing problems because they're self-employed and got into problems of milking the cows and all kinds of other things. But generally, in terms of the pay, many companies paid their normal rate. And that certainly should be encouraged, and maybe we could get some suggestions as to how that could be encouraged by more and more companies that they take that approach. So thank you for answering the questions.
And you know, in line with what you're saying and with what Justice Butler had said, we probably get your daycare provider who has involved with, you know, 10 or 12 other individuals' lives, your farmer, when it is, you know, particularly, are the two that come to mind the most, that should we excuse them, it very definitely, you know, has an impact on other families and other people other than that juror. And I think the courts bend over backwards from what I listened to with the other clerks in adjusting to that and giving them a different jury month, perhaps a farmer in a winter month or, you know, daycare workers at least adjusting and deferring them to a different month, too, if it really becomes a hardship.
I'm going to follow up Justice Crooks's question and just add one or two more. With regard to employer pay, I know this is anecdotal, do you experience any difference between those that would be low-income pay and above that? In other words, those who are working for close to minimum wage, Can you say that their employers generally also reimburse, or is there some kind of discrepancy between what would be the middle pay, you know, average, and those who are just scraping by?
I would not say that there is that much of a difference. Somewhat in contrast to that, and I don't know if that applies to larger counties, and I don't want to say that people are whining to get off of jury duty, but quite often we will see our professionals trying to get off because it's a, you know, great hardship to them to accept the $16 in their eyes than to get what they may get as a doctor in a hospital or something. So it cuts both ways.
Well, let's just ask this. Take somebody who works part-time at a fast food place, or take someone who works part-time or even full-time at a big box store, or anything like that. I think the import of the question is, what will that company do as to jury, if you know?
Okay, and I would have, again, from my experience, you know, the larger companies, the ones that we work with, and again, in Columbia County, there are not that many large companies that employ, you know, that we're seeing those jurors coming and going. For the most part, once our jurors are there, if we have not excused them originally, and once they're there, and once they become involved in the process, they're not grumbling or...
I'll have to ask you a question then. What is your rate of no-shows? That is, you send it out, you think that it's no return as no address or not here. What is your rate of not people just not coming?
Not coming for a particular summoned jury? I would say in the last year, I know we had 37 trials, and I think we had, and normally we would summons in around 33 jurors for each trial, and I think
about 1,000 roughly. Go ahead.
I think we had 7 or 8 people that did not show.
Okay.
We have an extremely good rate. But that doesn't mean that we have not had conversations with them on the phone and, you know, discussion back and forth. And then
how many warrants do you serve?
Pardon me?
How many warrants to get them in?
Our judges will not do warrants.
Okay.
Which leads us into the penalty phase that was addressed.
That's very good. That's a very good segue.
And the judge mentioned and talked, I'm not going to talk a lot about that, other than, again, from the practical point of view, when clerks get together, and whether it's a small group or the association, it has always been a comment as to what do we do with John Doe or Jane Smith that simply is not coming in or filling out that questionnaire. And a few years ago, there was a survey done with the judiciary and with the clerks, and it was all over the board in what was done. And it went anywhere from ignoring the jurors that didn't come to the issuance of warrants. So this petition has addressed that in trying to get a procedure that is practical, that will work. We worked with CCAP to develop a best procedure so that we know it can be done. As you had pointed out earlier, it is a constitutional right and for a trial by jury. And just having this penalty process in place should enhance the integrity of the whole system so that when you have the one juror, I was telling the committee just before we came in here, that just last in December, we had a juror that was summoned in, and we asked our jurors to be there at 8:45, and we begin court at 9 o'clock. This juror chose to come in at 10 to 10. And he argued with us that he was fulfilling his duty. He was here. He was late, but he was here. He did that twice. We summoned him in again, and he did the same thing. So it is those jurors that are, you know, trying to push the court a little bit, where the judge has the discretion to meet one-on-one with this juror. It's not about the money. It's about trying to instill with this juror the need for his or her participation in the jury process.
Ms. Raymer, if I could, I do want to follow up a bit the Chief's question and Justice Bradley's question. And I don't want to single out any specific company, so that's not the intent of my question. Mm-hmm. But I want to make sure that the question is clear. Many companies. They may be large umbrella companies like a McDonald's or a Burger King or a Kentucky Fried Chicken. They operate as franchises. They're individually owned or owned by smaller investors. And with companies like that, or small restaurants or things of this nature, and if you don't know the answer, that's fine, because we can ask other people. But is it your experience that those type of companies will pay the same type of rate that they would normally pay for an individual that was off for jury duty? Or do those individuals, just because they're not salary employees, but because they're hourly employees, sometimes part-time, are they just taking the day off? Do you understand the import of the question?
Yes. And it is my experience, again, very, very limited, and only from the feedback that we have gotten from the jurors, is that, yes, the companies do take that into consideration and will pay rather than just giving them the day off. Did I answer that?
If that's what they're doing, then you answer the question, yes.
You know, and again, that comes into the area of that kind of information. I know counties are becoming more and more where they are starting to do exit polls with their jurors to try and improve the system. We do it on a regular basis where we ask all those types of questions to get a feel. And I think that's becoming more and more popular, so we can get this kind of feedback.
Now that's your experience in your county. Do you know if that's the experience in counties like Milwaukee and Racine and Kenosha?
I would not venture a guess with Milwaukee on almost anything. They're an entity in themselves. And I don't know if Judge Patachik has any understanding. But I would say for counties relative to our size, we're a three-judge county. And, again, with that volume of juries, I would think that would be pretty representative.
Thank you, Ms. Raymer.
I'm sorry, yeah. Justice Presser.
There are some definitions here of things like jury array and jury year that you spoke of in your testimony. How much, if is there one jury array for the whole year?
Yes, your jury array is, in Columbia County, I ask for 3,000 names. In Racine County, they ask for 10,000. That is the jury array, and that is the names that we are given originally to start with. We then do some either a one-step or a two-step process of narrowing that down. Each clerk decides which way they're going to go, and that's a matter of sending out questionnaires, initial questionnaires, and we may get some returns saying, you know, this person is deceased, they have moved out of the county, whatever, and we get a reasonable, a lesser number, but a reasonable number to work with. And it is at that point, depending on your county's choice, in Columbia County, we divide them into 12 months, and we have jury service of a month, and that is your jury veneer that's referred to in there. Then we narrow it down when we know a jury is going to occur. We send out 2 weeks ahead of time 30 to 35 questionnaires. That's our jury panel. And the 12 or 13 that remain on the jury that are actually selected are our jury for that particular case.
If your jury year begins January 1, can you kind of talk through the time that is necessary to develop the jury array? In other words, how long will it take to get a list from the state and then to develop the jury array and all the questionnaires that you have to send out before you have that final?
Okay. When this was first discussed about the multiple lists and when those would be available and when the clerks could comfortably work with them, it was decided that if we had that list by October 1st of the year before, that would be ample time, whether you do a one-step or a two-step process, to go through that initial, get the jury array down to where it's workable, and be ready to go for January. Because normally we would send out for January jurors, we would have that about 6 weeks in advance, what our jury veneer is going to be for the month of January. And just as a quick follow-up, that on the confidential...
No dates are given in this
As to when that list is to be available? Yeah, and I know the committee spoke of October 1st, whether that would be something that when those source lists when a contract or an agreement or a memo of understanding was done with that agency, whether that is something I'm sure would be covered in with the director's office and that agency itself.
Thank you, Ms. I'm sorry. Any other questions or comments? Well, I want to thank you, and on behalf of the court, I want to thank the clerks who are very active not only in jury duty but in the whole administration of the circuit courts and actively participate in the committees of this court and the committees of the chief judges in bringing forth issues and resolutions. So thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Richardson, District 5 Court Administrator.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ms. Richardson.
I'm here as a member of the Chief Judge Jury Subcommittee and as staff to that subcommittee. And I would just like to confirm that the three reasons that we brought this petition before you were to improve minority representation, to improve privacy of jurors' personal information, and to respond to the uncertainty that was being several times a year reported to us as a committee that courts did not know how they should follow up on non-response and failures to appear. To improve minority representation, we determined that there's a two-pronged approach. One is to improve the addresses on the list, as Justice Tack said, to solve the problem of undeliverables and failures to appear. After study, we determined that the DOT list is representative. So when you start with that premise, the next problem was, where do we get better addresses? So that's our goal, not necessarily to find lists with more ranges of the population because we think we have that. We need better addresses. And you asked, one of the justices asked about the National Change of Address Program. DOT does that now with their list several times a year. So they're doing it for us. So there was no reason for us to duplicate that. The second prong for improving minority representation is in the follow-up, because as the others have mentioned, a second summons, a phone call if you're in a small county, and that person will come. Sometimes their problem is, oh, I just forgot, or I had a cold, or whatever. They come when you summons them. So it's not the monetary penalty, although that needs to be out there as the stick. The carrot is forgiveness, and please serve, it is your civic responsibility. So that's our goal. So if we can clarify this in the minds of judges and clerks around the state that they do have the authority to do this and here's how you do it, follow-up is the best improvement for undeliverables and non-responses, and that improves minority representation. Another question I'm trying to think of, the questions that you asked how many counties pay more than the $16 day minimum. As of 2006, there were only six that were still paying $16. You also asked about the targeted mailings. It's my personal preference that the approach the committee is taking is race neutral. If you start targeting populations with extra summonses or extra mailings, I think that sets the wrong approach as to how jury duty should be managed.
So is your position that you would not favor other kinds, use of other lists that might have more representation of any particular group? I would think that if there's a list of people who get services or financial support, that the addresses on that will be pretty current.
That's why we chose the list we did. There's either a legal requirement or a personal motivation for people to keep those lists up to date. If you're getting child support, you want to make sure your address is out there. If you want your hunting license, you have to give them your address. Paying taxes, that's a legal obligation for a current address. So that was our focus, finding lists with good addresses. If there's another list, we're certainly open to reviewing them, such as the tribal one, once we approach them, given their sovereign nation.
Ms. Richardson.
Go ahead.
You mentioned that there are six counties that currently still pay the $16 per hour. And I've got two related $16 per day. I've got two related questions. One is what the average across the state is, and two is, given that the largest minority population in the state is in Milwaukee County, what is Milwaukee County paying?
Milwaukee County pays the $16 a day and a different kind of mileage fee. They don't do a per mile, they do a flat rate.
So they're one of the six that only pay, yes. Pay only $16.
And what was the average across the state?
I think Judge Pataki's right. It's between 25 and 30.
Okay.
There are some. The highest is 45 as of 2006.
What about other states?
I believe Wisconsin is somewhat low compared to other states.
Oh, when you say that, do you have states paying a couple of $100 a day, or do you have states paying $52 a day? Do you know what I mean?
50 is not uncommon. There are several states that have developed a system where you get a very low rate of pay. Well, it's even higher than Wisconsin. But you get a somewhat lower rate of pay for your first day because they have like one day, one trial. And then if you're actually on a trial, after so many days, your payment rate goes up. But see, that's where when this committee looked into this about 5 years ago and did a survey, and we found that statewide about 50 to 55% of jurors are being paid by their employer when they serve, and that was consistent across rural and urban, big and small counties. But the subcommittee discussed coming to the court or to the legislature with a change in language to say that employers must pay. And we were discouraged from doing that, that it was never going to succeed, not by the court, by people in the legislature who could give us clues on that. And so we decided to tackle it another way. Another way to keep the burden on jurors short is to keep their service short. If we have shorter terms of service, if we have efficient use of jurors, you know, get them in, get them out, that saves the jurors having to lose so much pay.
Richardson, let me ask you this. We're talking about an issue that cuts across the state. But what is, in terms of the data that the committee looked at, where is the largest percentage of no-show of people of color? Is it kind of uniform throughout the state, or is it focused in a particular locale or locales?
It's completely focused in limited counties because there are many, many counties that have a very homogenous population. So you don't have that problem.
And which counties would that be?
That do or don't.
That where people aren't showing up, that people of color are not coming in for jury duty.
Milwaukee, Racine, Waukesha, Dane, Rock. In some counties, it's different population groups, whether it's Hmong or in Barron County, Somali. It's where there are significant populations of minority groups.
And to the best of your knowledge, is there anything that is consistent within those counties? For example, you mentioned the six counties that are still at the $16 per day. Is that consistent throughout the counties that you just mentioned? Or I'm just trying to focus on whether or not there's an overriding issue that cuts across the board that perhaps the court ought to be looking at.
There's no portrait of a county that's the same for everywhere. It's this county might pay 16 and have a very low non-appearance rate, and this county pays 35 but has a very high. I mean,
But I'm talking about the counties that have a large population of people of color, because since that seemed to be the import of your answer just a moment ago, that you've got counties like Dane and Rock and Kenosha and Racine and Milwaukee. Well, if you're looking at those counties, is the rate of pay the same within those counties? Are there other reasons that kind of cut across the lines that are consistent throughout the counties that might explain the large percentage of no-shows?
We've not identified any common factor like
right.
that. The payment rate is different. The degree of follow-up is different. The term of service is different. There's no one factor.
All right.
Now, go ahead.
Okay, and just the last thing I wanted to cover was the practical matters of implementing. If you chose to make these changes, we have worked with Jean Busquette and CCAP. CCAP is prepared to undertake these changes. They're ready. They can initiate that. CCAP has worked very closely with us in terms of generating reports so that the clerks and judges can track these changes and follow and see if we're making improvements based on the juror's status. And we are also putting out a manual for clerks and judges to help them use the new reports, the new CCAP functions, and better track their jury system.
We've talked about the pay. We've talked about the lists. We haven't talked very much about, we've talked about privacy as to Social Security numbers. We haven't talked about questionnaires that ask more than the minimum or required by the statute. Are you going to talk about that, or is someone else going to
talk about
that?
The vision of the committee was to find a balance between the information that the judges and the lawyers need to perform voir dire and the concerns of the jurors about their personal information, who has it, where it goes after it's done in court. And our solution was to allow the counties to develop their supplemental questionnaires the way they do now, to collect any information that the judge thinks is necessary for the trial, but it's used during voir dire and kept by the court in confidence after voir dire unless counsel or anyone for that matter can show good cause to the court why the juror's personal information should be released. The names of the jurors who are on the trial will be in the case file. That is not in any way being kept secret. And the lawyers are not being prevented from asking any question that they want during voir dire. It's just that after voir dire, that information goes into a sealed envelope only to be released on the judge's order.
If I remember correctly, there was some issue about defense counsel as to being able to use this information if need be after trial,
right,
especially if need be for appeal.
And we're fine if the language can be found to limit it to that. And I think in the materials you have, there is some suggested language that if juror conduct or juror selection is a matter of the appeal, then the juror records would be released to counsel.
They want it without showing cause and without an order from the court.
If it's a matter of direct appeal, the committee is acceptable.
That's acceptable if it's a matter of appeal.
Yeah.
Okay.
You just change, is it a matter, is there some reason that you're saying it's a matter of direct appeal?
Rather than post-conviction, that's what the remedy.
That was a discussion I had with Marla Steffens from the SPD
okay,
Appellate Office.
Here.
And,
okay.
And that was her language, direct appeal.
All right. We'll check that out. Steffens, you might be called upon. Anyone who sits here is in danger of being called upon.
Now there'll be a mass exodus.
The doors are sealed. That's a joke.
And Justice Prosser, I think you asked a question about what would the director's office do if there was an open records request for a Social Security number. We tried to address that. If we didn't reach a high enough level, happy to change the language, but we did say that all Social Security numbers shall be kept secure from unauthorized access and shall not be open to the public. And we thought that would be enough to answer an open records request.
Well, I wonder if that's right, because this is a court rule. Can't change substantive law. Open records are arguably, I don't want to have to decide that, arguably a substantive right to get a record. So I think you'd have to look in, which is what I was trying to do while I was also talking and listening. So it's a three-prong attack here. That whether or not on your public records, which then would refer you to open meetings, whether you don't... They wouldn't come under a particular confidentiality rule there. Do you have any understanding of what I'm saying? Good.
I think we didn't cover it.
Well, I think that you'd have to, I think it's arguable that you'd have to find something in 19.20 on open records, which will, I think, refer you to 1981 on open meetings, and that there will be something in there that that talks about exemptions. Do you know what I mean? Like confidential information, financial, medical, social, or personal histories, discipline. I haven't found it yet, but you know what I'm trying to do is find it there, because I don't know that the court can add a
by rule
add a confidentiality matter, because it is open is a legislative matter under 751.12. You can't affect a substantive right. So I mean, that's a problem. You know, who knows how it would be ruled on, depending on the facts that came up and looking at all the statutes, but I suggest that that might be examined.
We also based some of our thinking on the federal code that Judge Patak cited.
Well, you see, that a federal statute or regulation that said Social Security numbers are confidential would override the state statute too. I mean, on the usual preemption. Again, those are always very difficult areas and have many ifs, ands, and buts in it. But that's another way of dealing with it. And so that really, I think it's going to be covered, whether it's by federal statute or by something in Chapter 19. My sense is it will be covered. But there's a much more, it's much higher comfort level if you can point to a number and a line in the statutes. So I merely suggest.
Only in the federal code I can, that says we're allowed to use it.
Well, that may be good enough under supremacy. Remember, that's why we have the mural of the signing of the Constitution above this court rather than elsewhere, because that's the ultimate.
If I may, the Department of Justice filed a letter in response making several comments, and one of the comments is this, that the proposed rule is silent about how long the court should retain the juror qualifications forms. DOJ recommends discussion of this issue.
It's already in Supreme Court rule, the records retention schedule, 4 years.
Yes, that's right. Thanks. Yeah, you're right.
I wanted to raise one other issue with you, Ms. Richardson. You have been what I have always labeled you as, the jury guru in this state for a long time. And you have been the recipient of my mass mailings of anything that says jury on it. I just send it to you.
Yeah.
So for that, I apologize
profusely.
Do you accept your apology?
Got a big bookshelf.
Got a big bookshelf. One of the issues we've talked about is recognizing the people who serve on the juries. They serve leaving their families, leaving their jobs, coming in at $16, or with all due respect, even $45 for an entire day is not very much, considering what you might have to spend for someone to replace you in the home and take care of the kids, mm-hmm. et cetera. And then the job is not easy. Being a juror is not easy. Sometimes you have to listen to really gut-wrenching matters. And then making a decision is never easy.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
And then you have to live with that decision,
yes.
Which is also not easy. And so you and I and others have talked about the court system recognizing the work not only of the individual jurors, but of the employers who also pay a price of not having a member of the staff there, right?
Right.
And so how are we doing on juror appreciation?
Starting tomorrow, I can take it up full time. We were...
Ms. Richardson,
sort of been,
you're not done with this petition yet.
No, I've already worked with Tom Sheehan, of course you know him,
right.
Found me an intern, and I already have a draft sitting on my desk as soon as I can
materials.
Get to it. And our goal is to have a packet of camera-ready copy, ideas, samples, anything, out to the clerks by June 1st.
Great.
Still that's wonderful. Still doable? Good.
Hmm?
I really appreciate that. That's one of our many communications, and we all recognize that the first round of this might be small, and but that it's a start,
mm-hmm.
and that every year hereafter, the court system is committed to juror appreciation and recognition across the state, and we will continue it and improve it.
Yep.
And the month or week, have we decided on that yet?
September.
Good. Good. Well, thank you, Ms. Richardson, for all your work and continuing your work in this area for many years to come.
I hope so, too.
Good.
Thank you.
I have Karen Rotker of the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin. Counsel?
Thank you, Chief. Chief Justice Abramson and members of the court, we appreciate the opportunity to come and speak before you today. I apologize to the court and to those who've worked on this petition that we only got our comments in this morning. There are two sort of general issues that we wanted to address. One has to do with the jury lists, and one has to do with privacy. Let me start. In the context of the jury list, I would like to make explicit something that I think has sort of been implicit in a lot of the conversation and, frankly, implicit in our comments, and that is the overlapping relationship between income and race, at least in the state of Wisconsin. And I think that's important because we know from census data, I didn't bring it today, but I think it's pretty commonly known that for whatever reason, persons of color, communities of color in the state of Wisconsin tend to have lower incomes, in fact, significantly lower incomes than white non-Hispanic populations. So as we're looking at these issues and as we're talking about economic incentives or disincentives, that itself, I believe, has or may tend to have a racial impact in terms of jury participation, you know, or those economic impacts can be racialized. And I think that is a significant issue and is sort of an underlying subtext of a lot of this discussion. We have long had concerns about the use of Department of Transportation lists. I understand that it's being said today that at least the original DOT lists don't have racial disparities. There are a fair number of studies out there that show, in terms of what, once you're looking at who has current and valid driver's licenses, there is actually a fairly significant racial disparity, and that persons of color are much less likely than whites to have current and valid licenses, whether that's because of people's licenses being suspended for non-driving matters or for other reasons, I don't know, but there has been research done on that.
Well, are you satisfied that the petition is attempting
yes.
to broaden that? That yes. the petition is attempting to get lists that have people that might be lost in the broad sense, not appearing on Department of Transportation and up-to-date contact information. So my understanding is you just would like to add some other lists.
Yes, we would like to add because we commend the commission and we commend the petition for what it is attempting to do. We're not sure whether the lists it's proposing are adequate to achieve that goal.
Probably won't know until a couple of years out, I would assume.
I would assume, but what is available and what I did do is, you know, if you look at the existing rule, it does allow the use of AFDC lists. Now,
before you go to the additional list,
yeah.
maybe I misunderstood something, and I just want to make sure that I understand
sure.
what we're talking about with the DOT list. Are we talking about, with respect to the proposal, those that have valid Wisconsin driver's license? Are we talking about everything that's out there that would include the suspensions and the revocations?
You would have to address that.
I see nods in the back from Judge Patak there. I think it includes everything, but I'm not certain.
But if it includes the suspensions and revocations, it would not surprise me if those folks are less likely to keep DOT updated with their address.
Yeah.
And that may be part of where the problem is coming in. I mean, that, you know, sort of that, those systemic issues may be adding up so that 8 years down the road when someone's been suspended for 5 years, it's not really a surprise that we might not be able to find that person. What we tried to do, as I said, is look, you know, looking at the existing rule which allows the use of AFDC lists, which since AFDC hasn't existed since 1997, it's been a while since this has been updated. We went ahead, and it isn't included, but I sort of informally requested from the Department of Workforce Development and the Department of Health and Family Services sort of aggregate demographic information on participants in programs. I asked for unemployment compensation, what was the aggregate demographic information, and I went to law school because I am not a math whiz, but it looks like approximately 90% of the unemployment compensation recipients are white non-Hispanic. I then went ahead and asked Department of Health and Family Services for, it's called the CARES data, which is the DHFS computer system, client assistance, something. I'm not actually sure what it stands for, but it's the medical assistance, food stamps, child care subsidies, all of these are on CARES.
One data.
It is one database.
Okay.
Each program individually, like medical assistance individually, is significantly more diverse than the unemployment compensation list. Food stamp participation is even more diverse than that. It contains larger numbers of populations of color. Child care subsidy funding, the persons who receive child care assistance to go to work, contains substantially larger percentages of persons of color. And so our thought was that if the CARES lists were also aggregated, and first of all, as I believe you noted, Chief Justice, earlier, there's a strong incentive for those lists to be current because people's ongoing benefits, which are generally issued monthly, are contingent on having a current valid address in the system. Second, you're reaching apparently larger, very diverse populations. I don't know if this is an issue, but I do notice that women seem to be somewhat higher represented on the public assistance lists as well. So gender diversity as well. Because these are almost by definition lower, and a lot of these are working families, but almost by definition are lower wage workers or they wouldn't be eligible for these programs, you may be reaching people who for economic or other reasons, don't have driver's license access. So it seems like a good list, and you have to use your Social Security number to get these benefits. So it takes care of the concern of the unique identifier. Because it is a may, not a must, we would ask the court to include that now as something rather than waiting for further study in 2 or 3 years down the road. We believe that if we could say, yes, let's go ahead and add the public assistance list or the CARES list to the kinds of lists that can be considered.
There are all sorts of problems about that have nothing to do with this issue, namely whether data from one data bank can easily be moved and merged with another data bank.
Right.
So we're not even talking about that.
I'm not
prepared to tell us that.
I would not presume to tell anybody or speak to any database issue at all. But
we all recognize that these are technical problems if you can override the other problems.
That's correct. But it does strike me that if the committee believes that the unemployment compensation list would be useful, it strikes us that if the goal is diversification, that these would be at least as useful and likely even more useful. And we are talking about fairly substantial numbers of people on these programs. Now, obviously, some of them are children. Some are not going to qualify. But it's a lot of people who we believe could be picked up, as well as persons with disabilities who might not drive.
If you got children on that, and then they suddenly appear on the jury list, you get a problem.
Right. No, I assume that there's a way they can sort it through head of household. The data
assumption.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And it is because I have past experience before my current job working with programs that deal with the CARES system, and there are ways of sorting that as well.
Right, let's move to privacy.
So the other, if I may, Chief Justice, I also just want to state that we would also, although I was not aware of it, we would also support actually inclusion of tribal lists for the same reasons. And we do know that the tribes do keep lists and do have identification cards they provide. We know this from voting rights work that we've done, so we would support that as well. In terms of privacy, we do strongly believe that it is important to protect individual privacy rights. First of all, I believe it's 19.35 or 19.36 of the state statutes that may have the open records privacy sections in it in terms of identifying information. And we don't believe, certainly social security numbers, those kinds of issues have to be kept private. I believe there is also a federal statute. I share Justice Rogensack's concern with contractors with, you know, information being inadvertently disclosed. That's why actually one of our comments was also that we would support this, maintaining it within the higher levels of the state court system. We would be very concerned if, for example, the courts were to decide to subcontract this out to some other entity, because that seems to be the point where some of the privacy breaches occurred in the state system and would certainly not be something we would want to risk in the future.
You're looking at 1935 1 AM 1, I think. Go ahead.
Yeah, I believe that was...
I knew it was somewhere. Thank you. Got it.
You're welcome, Your Honor.
Anytime, right.
That is a concern to us. So we would want to make sure, again, not only that information is protected, but the systems that are set up keep that information in a small number of hands, certainly that even the Social Security numbers are not being sent out statewide, because that's where you seem to get greater risks of disclosure of public information or private information. We also believe that the source of the list themselves, that if at the state level there's going to be a single jury array compiled and matched in duplicates, it removed, that's appropriate. Once it's sent out, our understanding is that the intention is not that it's sent out with a little line item that says, oh, this person has a hunting license, or this person has a driver's license, or this person is on food stamps, but that it would just be single names, because an individual's participation in a particular program is the kind of information that we would also believe should be kept private. And frankly, by federal law, some of that information would need to be kept private anyway. And it is our understanding that is the intent, but I wanted to be explicit about that and about our concerns. On the other hand, we would not object from the other side, the perspective of information that might be necessary for, say, defense counsel, to say 25% of this list comes from driver's licenses and 10% comes from hunting licenses, or whatever the source list may be, just sort of as a general kind of public information issue, as long as there's not individually identifiable data attached to that. We also believe that there should be a balancing of the privacy and concerns and individual use of information against the broader goals of trying to diversify the jury pools. So, for example, if either the court or the committee that's in charge of setting this up balances and says, you know what, child support payers is really no more diverse, doesn't have any better addresses, isn't going to help us achieve this goal of diversity, doesn't have the demographics we're looking for, maybe then when we're looking at the may or must be used, that's one that should not be used, that each program should be balanced one at a time with the privacy interest versus the larger benefit that would accrue in that context. We also, because we value both privacy and individual notification. Now, I'm not saying informed consent, but we do think that if lists are going to be used, if a voter registration list, if a driver's license list is going to be used, there should at least be notification to the individual that, you know, this information may also be used for purposes of developing a jury list. We're not saying that people should be able to opt out, because that would not be a workable or a fair or a random system, but at least a sort of general notification provision is something that we would support as well. And should not be real. I mean, I'm thinking of an additional line on an application document when someone is signing up for a benefit. But those are sort of our concerns from the privacy perspective. And if I may, there was one additional point that was not in our written comments, but I would like to address, and I sort of alluded to it at the beginning, which is juror pay. And again, this goes back to the issue that I raised initially of the relationship between income and race. If
what do you think would be a pay for a day as jury duty that would overcome that problem?
I am not a social scientist, and I haven't studied this issue, but let me suggest, for example, minimum wage is about a little over $6 and $6.50 an hour, I believe, right now. Times eight, that puts it right around $50 a day. That's an example. And I'm thinking in the context, there are persons more learned than I who could say whether that would be adequate, but I'm thinking of people who work at temp agencies, which at least in some of the larger cities like Milwaukee is a lot of people, and I don't believe that in a lot of situations those persons get paid if they don't show up for work that day for whatever reason, or someone who might work at a daycare agency that has two or three employees where there may not be the financial resources to pay that person. It's not necessarily employers being evil or a certain perspective, but if you've got a little, you're working for a little tiny business, the employer themselves has to cover for you and may not have the resources to do that. And it certainly appears to be instinctively and anecdotally an issue, there have been comments made that a person could opt out for economic hardship, but if the people who are opting out are disproportionately people of color, which, given that those communities tend to have lower income, at least seems likely to be the case, then that problem would seem to undermine some of the progress that we're looking at making here with these petitions. And so we would also support an increase in juror pay.
Thank you, counsel.
May I ask a couple of questions?
Just a minute. Justice Prosser has a question.
Other than Social Security numbers, what are the principal concerns about privacy? Specific things.
Well, the disclosure of other personal identifying information, the disclosure of personal, as I said, if someone is receiving food stamps individually, those kinds of, you know, disclosure of those kinds of personal, private information. If someone has a hunting license, so I
what about an address? Some people don't have addresses in the phone numbers because they don't want others to know. What about number of children, age of children, names of children, employment of your husband, or wife?
Well, what I was, the chief has really hit in exactly what I was getting at. It seems to me, all these folks have served as jurors in
right.
a case, and I'm really angry at them.
Right.
Okay. It seems to me a public records request would reveal all of their addresses, for one thing. Suppose I'm an abuser of a spouse. We're separated.
Right.
I want to find that spouse. Do I get that through the jury records? What other things ought we be concerned about here?
And let me just say that the original comments were sort of the privacy concerns relative to the list, not sort of relative to the use of the information afterwards. I think that in general, the proposal to limit the personal identifying information, certainly it has to be available. That information has to be available for counsel for appellate purposes. It has to be available to the person, the participants in the system. I think the names are generally going, of the jurors are generally going to be available. My understanding, and I am not a criminal law practitioner, is that you can have sort of John Doe jurors. You can protect the identity of jurors in specific cases where there is a threat, a generalized threat to those jurors. But otherwise, I think generally limiting the amount of information that is publicly and broadly available in the open records context is also something that is going to encourage jurors to participate more, as opposed to the concern that if, for example, someone is a victim of domestic violence and the spouse can find out where that person is living, that might militate against someone participating in the system. I think it is, again, the kind of balancing act that we have to look at each piece of information on a case-by-case basis, and what level of privacy to afford the jurors in that context. But we are also all concerned with identity theft. I mean, that is an issue as well, which is why in particular the Social Security numbers, the program participation data, and those kinds of information are absolutely the kinds of things that we would want to have protected. And I would be happy to do some more research and come back. I know it's probably late with additional specific pieces of it. As I said, our approach here was looking at the privacy of the lists themselves, not the post-trial aspect of it, but I hope I've answered your question somewhat.
I wonder if you could articulate the case why greater juror diversity is a really desirable goal.
I think that when we look at the issue of including broad participation, I mean, jury duty is one of these civic obligations that we have talked about. I think that if there are, you know, we have talked about the equal opportunity for jury service. If there are certain communities who are intentionally or unintentionally or through administrative structures excluded from that process, first of all, that is denying certain communities the equal opportunity for jury service. And my underlying comment about the way the driver's license list works, I think actually is doing that right now. It's denying certain communities the equal opportunity for jury service. Second, I think that you want broader civic participation from people because it benefits society as a whole to have more participation from more sectors of society in the civic process, such as serving on juries. Third, we look at it also from the rights of, say, defendants, particularly criminal defendants, to have a representative jury. And if there are elements of the population who are systematically excluded, again, I'm not saying intentionally, but structurally more likely to be excluded, then I think that also violates not only society's rights, but the rights of defendants to fair trial, or it can lead to that result. Those are the three primary issues we have.
Fundamental to our system is that you're judged by a jury of your peers.
That's
and
right.
Sometimes the perception is that's not occurring. I mean, in Washington County, for example, with all due respect, the population was not always diverse. There were times when we would have a cross-section of people on our juries. There were other times when there would be a jury of all white people sitting in judgment of someone who wasn't. And from a judicial perspective, I remember times meeting with people on the jury who felt they wondered if that defendant thought they were getting a fair shake because the jury sitting in judgment of them, there could be the perception that they weren't their peer. So I think more diversity is always a better thing in a system of justice and with respect to
selecting juries. With respect to the issues that Justice Prosser raised, just as a practical matter, judges have a variety of tools available to them at the trial court level
Correct.
To deal with specific cases where certain uncertainties or concerns of a jury might come up. That happens on occasion, and you need to provide safeguards to deal with that individual situation. But certainly you wouldn't want an entire system set up to deal with the needle in the haystack kind of case. You want to have open information out there so that people can select juries with the most information that creates that fairness. So you want to have a system where you have that open disclosure and information. On the other hand, you want to give trial court judges the opportunity to provide the safeguards they need to in individual situations so you'll have people serve.
I agree with you. Thank you, Justice Ziegler. And again, our point is that certain information should be kept private, but general information is a different situation. With respect to your comment about Washington County, I believe some of the impetus for this actually came because there were several all-white juries coming out of Milwaukee County, which just strikes me as when I talk about the structural issues and the administrative programs that are leading, if you have it, when that is happening, there's clearly something structural going on that is not leading to a jury of peers. It even more emphasizes the sort of structural nature of the problem, which is why we are here today and which is why we are supporting these changes with our additional suggestions.
It's interesting, though, when the jurors even notice.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Next, hear from Mitchell Hagopian, Disability Rights. Is that who you're representing today,
yes,
counsel?
Yes, Disability Rights Wisconsin.
Good.
Good morning, Chief Justice Abrahamson and members of the court. I'll be brief this morning. Disability Rights Wisconsin is the state-designated federal protection and advocacy agency for people with disabilities. We're here basically to support the petition, generally with one small reservation. We think expanding the potential jury pool would be a good thing. We specifically support the ACLU's request to expand the lists that the state would use to create that to include the public assistance programs that Karen has already talked about this morning. And briefly, from the perspective of people with disabilities, the existing DOT list may not actually contain a sufficient number of names of people with disabilities because, obviously, disability would be one barrier to having a driver's license. In addition, the new lists that are proposed would also not necessarily increase the pool of people with disabilities who would be contacted to serve on jurors. For example, the unemployment compensation lists are based on people who get short-term assistance following unemployment. People with disabilities typically are not recipients of unemployment compensation benefits, either because they never qualify for them, or if they did qualify for them, they're long past the time when they would continue to receive those benefits. Likewise, the child support lists would not necessarily capture a large number of people with disabilities because people with disabilities, a large number of them would be childless adults, so they would not be involved with the child support system at all. So those are the kind of things where those kind of, as I looked at the lists that were being proposed, those were the two that would, you know, sort of aim towards capturing people of more diversity, and I don't think that they would necessarily work to increase the pool of people with disabilities who would be called to jury duty. So we support the ACLU's request to expand the number of lists that the state could consider to include the public assistance rolls. And the other reason is because, of course, many people with disabilities are on those public assistance rolls, either especially the medical assistance program and the food stamp program. So you would actually probably result in a larger pool of people with disabilities if you used those lists. The only reservation we have about the petition as it's currently drafted would be on the penalty section. As proposed, the penalty for no-shows would increase to potentially $500 for not showing up to the jury call. Especially if we end up expanding the list of people who would be included in this to public assistance roles, we would have a concern about the potential amount of that fine for people who may have reasons for not showing up and not even showing up once they're called a second or a third time. So we would ask the court to reconsider that upper amount to a lower amount. We also note that it is equivalent potentially to the same amount as a clerk of court could be subjected to if they engage in fraud in the juror selection process. And it seems to me that the penalty for fraudulent tampering with the jury list should be probably higher than the penalty that could potentially be imposed against someone who just doesn't show up to the jury call.
So, Gopin, one question that just popped into my mind. I'm sorry I didn't ask it, and maybe Judge Patak will respond to this if he's called back up. But we're talking in terms of the penalty being amended to include up to a $500 forfeiture. And just dawned on me, are we talking about a $500 forfeiture inclusive of costs? It's going to be $500 plus costs, right? Costs and mandatory surcharges, or no?
I don't know, Justice Butler, but...
Maybe Justice Patak can answer that when he comes back. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I don't have anyone else on my list, but a question arose about the public defender's view about use of information, whether it be the basic information or the supplemental information, after trial. And if I understood the query, it was, are we limiting their use to just direct appeals, or does it include post-conviction remedies, et cetera? Are you willing to respond to that, Ms. Stevens? If you cannot, that's fine, and we can make further inquiry later. State your name, please.
Marla Stevens, Public Defender's Office. We did file written comments seeking to preserve the status quo for attorneys who are representing people on appeal or at trial. And in my discussions with Ms. Richardson on Friday, I do recall using the words direct appeal. My concern is that the current statutory provisions allowing counsel to request a copy of the court record continue to be interpreted to include information about the jury panel, meaning names, peremptories, and community of residence.
That's it.
Now, the other point that I made with Ms. Richardson is that if there is an allegation of juror misconduct or an issue with respect to jury selection, I was concerned that attorneys would have to show cause beyond saying, I need to investigate a claim of thus and so, because I don't think that the attorney would ever be able to show that cause. So I was hoping that the rule could be clarified, or at least a comment could be inserted indicating that it's not necessary for an attorney to show cause other than to say, I need to investigate a claim with respect to conduct or selection.
What about the defendant who's representing himself? Shouldn't he have the same rights as the attorney would if he's concerned about jury misconduct? And where does that leave our privacy?
Well, the state constitution requires that we afford an injured person the same appeal as we afford anyone else. So the general answer to the question is, yes, we do have to provide that information if this person wants to allege some type of misconduct. There are, I believe, provisions that circuit court judges and appellate court judges can utilize to say, well, I'm going to let you access this information, but I'm going to control the setting within which you do that. And I'm not really prepared to go into more than that, but I think that might be the best way to address that issue.
I don't. How would you control the setting for someone who's confined in a state institution and they want to have access to the names, addresses, races, whatever other kind of information might be there for use in voir dire to determine what may have occurred in their view?
I don't know. Other than to say, I mean, you can control the place in which they look at the records. Now, as opposed to sending the records to that person, you might want to send those records to that person's social worker within the institution and specify what may or may not be done. But other than that, I can't really be specific without knowing what are the concerns, what was the offense, who are we talking about. Those are the kinds of things that I think we have to trust the judges to address and be sensitive to when you have pro se litigants.
It's a hard question because they have the same rights as anyone else before the court. So I think it's a very hard question.
It's something that we bump up against quite a bit.
Yeah. I would imagine every once in a while you bump it up against it in the context of a pre-sentence report. A person serving time in prison has some concerns in their perhaps post-conviction release or their post-conviction appeal and want access to pre-sentence report.
Yes.
Have you ever had that experience?
Actually, that particular experience became the subject of subject for this court decide in the no merit context, yes, because if a sentencing issue is something that an appellant wants to discuss in a no merit context, it's very difficult to discuss that without being allowed to look at the pre-sentence investigation report. So this court set out some parameters for incarcerated and pro se defendants having access to those things. So that's probably a good guidepost right now.
But hard to legislate.
Very hard. Very hard.
To do it on a case-by-case basis, to figure out what are the ultimate criteria that could be applied in an abstract kind of way. Right. But do you want to say anything else?
The only other thing I wanted to say, I've not seen any proposed alternate language, but I just wanted to clarify that as long as peremptory's name and community of residence are part of the court record, that's enough, I think, for any appellate attorney to start with. And if
that's not addresses necessarily, just that it's in the city or county, that's not spouse's name.
And that's currently what we get.
Okay.
And that's very workable.
All right.
The second matter that we raised in our comments was allowing the trial attorney to retain information about the jurors subsequent to voir dire, but up until the time that the case is concluded. And when I spoke with Ms. Richardson about this, it occurs to me that the crux of our problem with the proposed rule is requiring a motion and an order for the trial attorney to have access to that after voir dire. And that seems to be more work than is necessary, really. I think what we're really talking about is giving the trial attorney the opportunity to access the information until the case is over.
Necessarily. It's okay if they give the information to the court. Court keeps it. If they suddenly on day two think they need the, just go into the court.
Just ask the court, could I see that again?
What do you need that kind of information for on day two?
On day two, generally you don't. Generally, when trial attorneys need it is after the verdict and prior to the entry of the final order, be that sentencing or some other final order in the case. And
they're just being cautious during trial and asking for that.
Well, during trial, I mean, my experience is that if an issue about misconduct comes up during trial, you're going to raise it right away.
Then you'll have cause.
Right.
But otherwise,
once there's been a verdict in a case, the most common reason for attorneys to want to look at juror information is to see if the jurors would be willing to give them informal feedback about their own performance in the case.
Once they leave the courthouse and you only have their names, it may be hard to find them in a phone book.
Right. And that's something that does occur now, I think, without a great deal of difficulty. I think most attorneys are very cognizant of their ethical responsibilities and their duties as officers of the court. So, and the other reason would be to attempt to investigate some type of claim about misconduct or about something about the selection of the jury that would come up before sentencing. So until the case is disposed of by final order, I don't think it's necessary. I think our request, our comments imply that we think the attorney should be able to walk out of the courthouse with it. I really don't think that's necessary. The crux of the concern was, please don't make us file a motion, and please don't make the courts enter an order on that motion just to have us look at the information while the case is still in the court.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you. Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to appear on this matter? Judge Patak or Gail Richardson, sum up, Judge?
Thank you. I just have a couple of comments in response to some of the questions that have been asked. It may seem disjointed, but I want to try to hit on those things as I was taking some notes here. Regarding Justice Butler's question about the DL list, it does contain anyone who's ever had a driver's license. So whether a person is suspended or revoked, their name is still on the list. Whether they have a valid license, their name is on the DOT list. With respect to issues regarding the list and how it would be merged and where it would be kept, we aren't going to contract out. We have CCAP in-house in the director's office, and so it would be maintained here. However, there are concerns that come with respect to maintaining data at the state level, because I can envision, for example, a question coming in an appeal as to how a list may have been compiled. And it might be necessary under those circumstances to get to the data, to figure out, you know, if we're merging lists, what lists they came from and so on, and how that was done. And that, I think, needs to be able to be reconstructed. Also, we are trying to improve the system here. And I think the committee's purpose and the way we want to do this is we want to see what the effect is. In other words, when we merge a list with the DOT list, we want to be able to go back and see if it worked or not. Did it make it better? And so on. And one of the ways that things we would need to do that is to be figuring out what the source of the lists, the names were that got merged into these lists, and whether this list that we're merging with the DOT list helped us or not. Okay, so we will need that at the state level, not at the clerk's level, to be able to analyze the effect of this. There is, in my opinion, a danger in putting lists in the statute by your order without us having a chance to kind of analyze the list to see whether they're suitable for this purpose. And again, I don't mean to be controlling on the part of the committee, but if you look at the current statute, among the things in that statute are such things as high school graduation lists, municipal and telephone directories, there are other things that are utility lists. In my experience as a lawyer and a judge for 30 years now, more than that, I've never known any county to ever be able to use any of those lists under the old statute to merge them to improve the system. I guess my point is this. We want to make sure that if we're going to put something in the statute, that it's a list that will work. And, you know, I'm not saying I disagree with the position that's been stated here. I'm saying we want to take a look and see whether we would recommend to you that a list be added here if it's going to be in statutory language.
I see that the penalties, if there are forfeitures, would go to the county.
Yes. It says the clerk of courts, but in effect, in reality, that is the county. It would go to the clerk of courts, who is a county agency, and depending on the county and the way they're structured in terms of handling money, it in effect goes to the county.
And if I could follow up, and I think you were about ready to address this, I've taken a quick look at Chapter 756 and Chapter 814, and it's not clear to me whether or not the forfeiture that's listed is going to be inclusive of costs and surcharges, and I was wondering if you could address that.
We had a discussion at length among the committee members, and the consensus is that it would not include costs, surcharges. It would simply be a flat amount of money.
And
a forfeiture.
Will the cost be added to it?
No,
it's just
added.
A flat amount of money.
Correct.
Since you all have discussed it, is it clear which provision of the statutes would govern that would make it clear that the counties don't have to impose a surcharge and an additional statutory mandated cost? Because I looked for it and I can't find it.
There is no statute as such. It is listed in the best practices document that we've set forth, and we've got copies of that here we can give to staff to distribute to you if you'd like to see that as part of your discussion here.
One of the things that Ms. Richardson indicated is that tomorrow she wants to start on a new project. And doesn't your asking the court to hold off, in essence, ask this court to hold off finalizing this matter?
No, I think what we're asking is that, as we indicated with the list's request from the tribes, that if we have a chance to look at those things, evaluate them, and we feel that there are lists that should be added here, we'll ask for further amendments to the petition. We're not asking you to hold up now. The other thing I'll say is, in a county where I work as a trial judge and where we have a significant minority population in a number of areas, number of ethnic groups, I would have to say that as I sit in a courtroom and look at a defendant who is of a minority group, and as I see a jury that may end up, in some cases, being a non-all-white or not having any people of the defendant's ethnic group, I agree with what Justice Ziegler has said here, and that is it really does affect the integrity of the result and the concept and the perception people have of how fairly they were treated by what we've done. And I think that, you know, it's imperative for us to try to do the best job we can to raise the level of participation, to reflect, to mirror the community. Understanding, if you think about it, statistically, there will be those cases where we hit it right on the head when we bring the jury into the courtroom if we're perfect with our numbers. But there will also be those circumstances where there will be fewer, and there will be those circumstances where there'll be more than if we hit it on the nail on the head. So, you know, nothing will ever be perfect here. But we need to do the best job we can to make where we start with this process of selection randomly to be as perfectly matching and mirroring our population as we can.
Your Honor, you ask us to hold up and wait for you, so sounds reasonable, but the devil's in the detail. What do you expect the process and the length of the process of review and petition and amendment to be? We have before us a couple of requests, one regarding the tribal lists, another regarding the public assistance lists. How do you envision this playing out, that we would do this in another 12 months?
In terms of the committee's work, the committee is standing committee, as it would be. There are no standing committees of the chief judges. They come and they go, as do chief judges. But this committee is, in fact, a standing committee by all practical, for all practical purposes. It continues to exist. So the committee meets, if it has to, and is working on a project monthly. It relies on Gail and other members of the director's office staff to provide the support and to do the work. So, you know, I don't want to speak for them, but it certainly seems to me that time schedule would be more than reasonable if that were your decision. and perhaps less. And I don't think it would take any longer than that.
We might take a little longer once you file the petition.
And I'm a lame duck chief judge, understand, so I'll probably not be involved in the final product if that were to happen.
That may mean that you'll be on the committee. That might mean you'll be on the committee.
All right.
One other thing I wanted to point out is the question of the voir dire and the use of the questionnaires. I'm surprised that we had a response from the public defender's office. We didn't get a response from the prosecutor's side, and I'll tell you why. In my experience, in many counties, the DA's office will go to the clerk's office once they know and have identified a group of jurors will be used in a given period of time, such as a week. And they'll ask for copies of those questionnaires up front so that they can have record checks done to have available when they go through the voir dire process, and they'll know really what the background of jurors is. So this will have an effect on that. I'll also tell you the common practice. Well, they won't have access to the questionnaires. They won't be able to go to the clerk's office and say.
Prosecutors and defense.
Correct.
Neither one.
Correct.
Civil cases, too. We keep talking about criminal cases.
Correct.
There are a lot of civil cases with juries.
Also, we're changing something here in that we're keeping these questionnaires in the court file in an envelope. I will tell you the common practice now is questionnaires will be available when the trial is being conducted. When the trial's over, the questionnaires, you know, are generally returned to the clerk's office and held by the jury clerk there and not necessarily placed in the court file. So we're doing something more here by keeping those questionnaires in a sealed envelope in the court file. I think that's about what I have here. Again, our desire is that you give us a chance to review the proposed list that you might want to add here, that we give you our feedback and make further changes beyond what's listed here. I also want to acknowledge the chief's recognition of Gail. You know, chief judges, chairmen of the committee come and go, but Gail is always there and continues to be the base of this effort and is the resident expert on jury.
Judge, just a detailed question. You speak of the list being in a sealed envelope in the court file after voir dire. It's hard for me to imagine that without a court order, a sealed document becomes unsealed. The public defender is saying, hey, let's keep the status quo and be able to view some of this information without court, during the course of the trial or while the case is still before the trial court, without a motion and order. How does that work?
Well, I think it works like everything else in the court file that's sealed, such as a financial disclosure statement in a divorce, such as a pre-sentence report, which is statutorily required to be kept confidential. I think it's very workable to make an oral motion in the course of a trial to look at a document that could be responded to by the court and the parties in the course of trial.
And after trial, let's say the verdict comes in and 2 days later they want to look at it. As I understand it, the status quo is now that they would have that information available.
The status quo is they have the information available.
Without a motion and order.
Correct. With they have the information available now, and they will with respect to name, geographic location.
And what about the other information if they are concerned about some kind of misconduct or a basis for a claim for relief?
Well, I would point out, I think the comment of the public defender's office that it's a rare incident that this occurs. It doesn't occur very often. In my experience, it's very rare that that's the basis for appellate work. And courts are available. I mean, you know, we're there and available to hear motions, to sign orders if they're presented. If a stipulation is presented in order, we're there to sign it. We would do that.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you all. Thank you.
Although
excuse me, Chief, if I could.
Justice Butler.
Judge, if I could ask one question based on your experience, and you may not have an answer, and I appreciate that if you don't, but I want to follow up on one one of the earlier questions I asked of what, I'm not sure if it was of Ms. Raymer or Ms. Richardson. But in Racine County, when you're dealing with those type of franchise-type operations that pay minimum wage salaries on an hourly basis, has it been your experience, or do you know whether or not those operations will pay a person when they've been scheduled for work and now they have to take off for jury duty, whether they will be reimbursed at the salary that they would have made for those hours that they've missed, or that they've just simply taken a day off and are left with the fee that's been provided?
I don't have an answer for you. I've never surveyed that. As you know from having been a judge, you don't have a lot of direct contact with
right.
the jurors. That's the clerk's direct contact. You may see them, as Justice Ziegler suggested, after the trial is over as a accommodation to them to allow them to ask you questions privately, make comments, et cetera, express concerns. But you don't generally talk about that. I will tell you that in our community, most of the employers, larger employers, such as healthcare providers, education system, large companies, et cetera, do pay the salary, but I cannot give you an answer with respect to the franchise-type business. Thank you.
Judge, although I recognize the work of Ms. Richardson, because I've seen it and worked with her on it, you're very kind in recognizing her value, but the chief judges and all the members of the committee, which is much more diverse than just the chief judges or district court administrators or even clerks of court, have done a massive amount of work and research and effort to come before this court, and the court appreciates that.
Well, and thank your the director's staff, too, should be commented as well. Thank you.
As always.
Thanks.
Thank you. That concludes our hearing on Rules Petition 0801 in the matter of the Amendment of Rules of Pleading Practice and Procedure, Wisconsin Statute 756, relating to juries. The court will take its recess for lunch, and it will reconvene at 1:30, and we will then discuss 0801. We will then discuss 0712 in the matter of video conferencing. We will then move on to 0403, and we will probably not get to 0711 relating to discretionary transfer, but one can never tell until we sit down and start talking. So we are in recess until 1:30.